Tune in to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and be part of an in-depth discussion on events you didn't know you needed to hear until you do, from Namibia, Africa, and around the world. Tune in from Monday to Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. only on Eagle FM.
Lipurana ngeno wapumbwa evalelo koma update o local, regional and international economic, political, financial or any type of update. That's why you need to tune in. All you just have to do is tune in Home Run and we'll take it from there. All you just have to do is tune in. There's a Helmut and Dwight to basically sift through a bunch of all this. It's actually very, it's somewhat of a nerd-ish, geek-ish job, but it's fascinating. The only thing is you don't have to have a social life, which is not, it's not a very big trade-off if you not having a social life is your life. Good afternoon and welcome to Home Run with Helmut on Eagle FM, here to keep you company until the hour of 6. And this is Home Run with Helmut and, Dwight on Eagle FM, your drive time show. You don't have to worry about calling. It took me a while to know that a lot of you are like behind the scene listeners. But now that I know, and I was like, am I talking to myself? Is there anyone listening? And then I ran into a lot of my fans. Wherever I go, I'm like, oh, they're listening. That's just awesome. So now that I'm famous, the only part I have to work on is the broke part. Once that part is sorted, then I can use the phrase rich and famous. Now, famous, yes. Broke, check. That's the problem. All the other ways I can, all the other ways that I can, use to make money quickly are either illegal, immoral, or both. And, so I just decided, hold on for dear life until, hold on for dear life and grind until the day that, I managed to accomplish that dream. And, baby steps. Don't end up in front of Inambao, explaining things. Just, take a few steps, one step at a time. You got this. Now that I've finished, giving you and myself all that, economic motivation, let's dive into today's discussion. And today we're going to talk about, Antonio Guterres, the outgoing United Nations Secretary General. And they've come a long way. I've been following the United Nations Secretary General, since the time of, Boutros Ghali of Egypt to Ban Ki-moon of South Korea, then came Kofi Annan of Nigeria, then Antonio Guterres. And he's from Portugal. And it wasn't until, it's actually something that I never paid attention to. It turns out the man is a physicist by training. And I was like, oh, okay. But, I mean, that explains why he makes a lot of sense. Because, it's very easy to tell when someone, in office majored in a STEM subject and when they majored in a lying subject. When I say lying subject, I mean, humanitarian and law and humanitarian things like your psychology, media. You can easily tell when a leader majored in the, because one, their English is just spot on. And they're very good at making promises. They are terrible at keeping, among other things. So, the Secretary General of, the outgoing Secretary General of the United Nations, on the 29th of January, gave a press conference on his 2026 priorities. This is finally in office. I believe this is his final year in office. Who is going to take over, I wonder? The new Secretary General of the United Nations. And whoever is going to take over is going to face immense pressure because of the current political atmosphere and a global political atmosphere with a multipolarity, unipolarity, division and open market economy to, how to put this, is it open market economy? just take all, you know, just take everything, finance, governance, economics, and just put them, you know, in that multipolarity, in a multi versus unipolarity division. Because those are like two main divisions, because there are countries that are like, you know what, well, let's just stick to the traditional way of doing things. And you have some that are going, you know what, no, we are, you know, it's time for multipolarity. Gone are the days of, you know, one guy just deciding everything. And speaking of gone are the days of one guy deciding everything, gone are the days of one guy speaking all the time. On Eagle FM. Hey, Dwight.
I'm being alone.
Yeah. Gone are the
days. Let me apologize. I'm sorry.
For what?
I'm sorry for having
Well, it was a good thing to basically go and catch him. Break the work-home routine, at least physically.
True.
Because I know that online.
The funny thing is obviously also, you know, that I should probably be lucky that no democratization has taken place, you know, as what's our buddy's name? I think which equity is going to change. A quick technical change to
like that
back right now.
Yeah, so
that's better.
Yeah.
So
the particular, how do you call it, the particular good thing so far, advantageous, should I say rather, has been that Donald Trump hasn't decided to democratize anyone else. I mean, today's the 4th of February. We must be lucky, Helmut.
So Greenland is still pending democracy.
Well, it's Greenland and Iran, you know. There's always a bad guy somewhere. Greenland is not a bad guy yet.
Yeah.
It's just the debates out there. But it's also something that actually factors into the discussion you had a little bit earlier in the, not earlier in the month, because earlier in the month was literally back on Monday. So specifically back on, when was it that you did the global risk report? The global, I think that was last week.
Global risk report.
Yeah, the one from the World Economic Forum.
Oh, yeah. That was last week, yeah.
Yeah, so Guterres, and he literally made that statement, which is technically based upon our discussion today. He made the statement a whole, I think, 2 or 3 days after that report, after that discussion. Or technically, it was a week after that report came out, more than a week. And it's literally, I think, a day after you did the discussion that he had this discussion in terms of the United Nations 2026 priorities. And yes, for our social media poster, we single it out specifically as Guterres didn't say anything looks shiny. He did, however, highlight a lot of shaky things and a lot of risk aspect or a risk induced or risk drenched aspects and developments, which is obviously some of the particular things that he's had to look at. And I think one of his biggest concerns that he did not list in his speech, Helmut, was the peace board or the board of peace, that funny thing that Trump launched at the end of the World Economic Forum situation with the weird, I won't call them weird nations, but here's the thing. If the whole of the AU was not invited, let me say this again, guys. If the whole of Africa did not get a single invite, not even Morocco, who at one stage was contemplating joining the EU, the whole of Africa didn't get an invite. Argentina, that doesn't have a functioning economy, Helmut, got an invite.
You know what's my favorite part about the Board of Peace?
Yeah.
Canada. Canada was invited until the Prime Minister's speech, then Trump was like, on second thoughts.
You know, give us back that invite. Give it, we know you didn't accept it, just give it back.
You're not supposed to criticize them. Like, in other words, this is a dictatorship, buddy.
Yeah.
Don't ask questions, just follow along.
Yeah. So, Guterres didn't make reference to anything like the Board of Peace.
Yeah.
He cited specifically that the only thing he cited in that development, after that development, was literally the world should not be torn into two opposite poles just because two countries want to decide the future of the world.
Yeah.
Now, many people don't talk about Helmut that the vice president, the Chinese vice president, was also at the World Economic Forum. He gave a very, his speech was even more, what you call it, if you know, if you're looking for those people that give you like those inspiring speeches,
mm-hmm.
his speech was literally something like that, yeah. where he literally said, guys, let's work together. Yes, we know we are aiming to be the world's factory. We know it, but we're here to work with you. Don't look here as primarily as a problem country or problem nation. Now, when Donald Trump stepped in 2025,
yeah.
on 20 January 2025 last year, the aims were clear that he was doing away with the policy that Joe Biden had of vilifying Russia, but working with China. And he flipped it. He switched it over. He
flipped it out, you know, like upside down.
Yeah.
By vilifying now, China, working with Russia.
Exactly. By now, continuing where he left off in 2020 or 2021 when he lost the elections, by continuing or reigniting the particular trade, the trade war that he had with China,
mm-hmm.
something that he began. Now, this is also something in the pipeline specifically, Hamid, because earlier today on our socials, we mentioned that Donald Trump extended the AGOA treaty, the agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what the U.S. representative says for the motivations why the U.S. president did this?
Oh, boy.
I'm giving you a big guess, Helmut. And you would have seen the language throughout the whole of 2025 when he stepped in. Remember that first month? What was the first thing he did?
The America First rhetoric?
Yeah. And the fear that I could already, that I immediately felt specifically,
yeah.
was when the U.S. Trade Representative, Jamison Greer, mentioned that the new AGOA agreement should actually mean a lot more for the U.S. from trade partners. Where have we heard such language before? Remember the tariff policy of the whole of 2025?
Yep.
That was language front and center. Poor Lesotho was slapped with an ugly, I think it was what, about 55, 50% and 45%? It was Mr. Lesotho, Vietnam. There was another small country, which everyone was like, what did these two small countries do? Vietnam has got 100 years worth of grudges against the U.S.
Yeah.
for the Vietnam War. What did Lesotho do? And Lesotho is probably half of Namibia's population size. So when, you know, specifically I read that update coming through, I also went like, I thought to myself, okay, so there was a bill that we spoke of about at the start of this year. There was a bill brought forward by a couple of U.S. senators or Congress people to literally to renew the agreement up to 2028.
AGOA agreement. Yeah.
However, as you and I know, it's just a bill. A bill is just a work in the process.
Yeah.
It's just words on a piece of paper. That paper can be rejected. Donald Trump does the immediate intervention of extending up to December of this year, 31 December 2026.
Yeah.
And then from there, the scenario is based upon a revised agreement.
You know, these inconsistencies in governance for both domestic, you know, in terms of both domestic and foreign policies, especially in a big, you know, in large economies mm-hmm. like the U.S., especially the U.S. is an easy, you know, is an easy example. You say why I think the CEOs of I think that was the CEO of Chevron.
Yeah.
Chevron or Exxon Mobil, when Donald Trump, you know, had that meeting after, you know, just, shortly after the whole, you know, kidnapping Maduro thing, he gathered around all the executives, you know, oil executives, to sort of like tell them, you know what, well, Venezuela is basically up for, we can decide what we want to do with their oil. But, some CEOs, I think that was the CEO, I'm not sure if that was the CEO of Chevron or ExxonMobil, you know, they were reluctant to basically participate in that, if you, assuming you can even call it a business idea. But you can totally understand why, or at least I can, because Trump is in office until what, 23rd?
Yes, or is it
2029,
yeah.
And then he's out of office. Now, if you look at the, you know, sort of like the Jim and Jake, like jump rope in terms of, of both domestic and foreign policy that Republicans and Democrats, play, is that when, you're looking at progressiveness and conservativeness. Yeah, so Republicans are more conservative. Yeah. Democrats are more progressive. So policies are going to shift depending on who is in office.
Yeah.
So Republicans are in office right now. So they can tell you that you can go into Venezuela, put this amount of money, and then, your safety, the safety for the period that you are waiting for the return of your investment is guaranteed.
Mm.
And then 5 years down the line, Democrats comes into office.
Mm.
And then they start flipping, flipping the script, like you just pointed out. When Democrats were in office, Russia was the enemy. China was the friend.
Mm.
Now that Republicans are in office, Russia is the friend. China is the enemy.
Yeah.
All this flip-flopping is, will make everyone that's being asked to invest in an industry that takes very long for an investor to see their return investment to think twice. Because, the oil and gas industry, we have an excellent example with our own baseline survey here at home. It doesn't take 5 years.
No, it doesn't. And the downside has also been, Almut, I think it was last night or earlier this morning, I watched a Richard Wolff engagement with a guy that, he's a Venezuelan specifically, but is it a Venezuelan American? And he asked him specifically that question about the offering of the oil resource,
the oil execs
of Venezuela to the oil executives. And literally, first and foremost, it's the reaction we didn't see much of, even though you cited one. We didn't see it much of it publicly, but there were rumors going about that the American oil executives were saying, not under these conditions do we want to enter a country like Venezuela, firstly.
Yeah,
because do you want Venezuela to be Iraq 2.0? Specifically where, the American army has to look after, like what the French army did with the uranium mines in Mali.
Yeah.
Because the Malian the Malian army does not know how to deal with jihadists.
Insurgencies, yeah.
And Islamic insurgents. And the biggest problem, if anyone knows primarily of what's happening in Mali or what has happened in Mali, is that you don't hear very much about Mali and Niger that suffer or that struggle to literally bring the Islamic insurgency problem that they suffer from under control. Now, it's the same issue specifically with Niger that is making it problematic for Nigeria. Now, when you go into a country like what happened now with Venezuela, Richard Wolff literally asked this writer. He's more an activist slash I'll call him a rebel journalist, because you get journalists that have complete issues with government, front and center. You can literally see it on their faces. They have an issue with government. No system of government is the best system. Anyone that looks like a politician is just sort of like the enemy.
I have an example, but I don't have bodyguards, so
no,
go on.
Please don't. please don't, Helmut.
It's
the February, Helmut. Please don't. So, when you look at that scenario, this gentleman explained to Wolf literally, who wants to touch a hot potato like Venezuela right now as a oil company?
Mm-hmm.
Because yes, there were all the negative things that happened pre-Hugo Chavez, and when Hugo Chavez came into power, and obviously after Maduro, succeeded after Chavez's death, no big company from the United States primarily wants to go into Venezuela on the back of literally what happened now. Now, here's the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
You and I, we heard we kept hearing, and the world is being told, that supposedly what happened in Venezuela was bloodless. There was no blood spilled.
There's no such a thing as a bloodless coup.
That gentleman confirmed now to Wolf.
Yeah.
Either today or yesterday. He did the interview yesterday, and he aired yesterday on his YouTube channel. That primarily, it was hundreds of Venezuelan people. Specifically security forces, guards, because there were also Cuban guards that Maduro had used and contracted from Cuba, and military advisors and the likes, or security advisors that came from Cuba. How is that bloodless specifically? If that guy can confirm specifically now to the world that hundreds of people had died because of, like Guterres explained, Guterres didn't mention names.
Mm-mm.
I can only read the excerpt. Where he said, we are living in a world where actions, especially reckless ones, are provoking dangerous reactions. Because that's a reckless action.
Yeah.
Of what happened on 3 January.
It's
a reckless action. But obviously, the biggest, sort of like, if I can call it like the biggest humdinger of a statement that he made, Guterres himself, and that's also to sum up the situation that we are actually now sketching for you, dear listeners, here on The Home Run, is that Guterres notes, and I did not know the guy was a physics.
I thought it was just a physicist by training. Yeah,
I thought he was a lawyer because I read up somewhere that he had law training or legal training as a lawyer. You know that it was in your vocation.
Now,
okay, to call it vocation.
It was yesterday or 2 years ago. Yesterday or 3 days ago when going through the speech.
Yeah,
that's when I was like, hang on a second.
Why is he referencing physics?
Physicist.
And then I went and looked up on his profile, and then it literally said he went to university in Portugal for physics and other sort of like technical training, and he did teach.
Yeah, because physicist, that's his field of specialization.
Yeah. So this particular part where he starts off by saying, these are early days, but 2026 is already shaping up to be a year of constant surprises and chaos.
Yeah.
Now this is where it goes on. Before I entered public life, I trained as a physicist. And in terms of profound flux, I returned to some of the fixed principles that explain how forces act upon the world. One stands out, Newton's third law of motion.
Yeah.
Now, if you guys didn't know this, and if you selectively forgot your high school education, it states, for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. So far, we obviously still have to see the reactions.
Yeah.
Of 3 January. Because remember, Helmut, 3 January, January is unresolved. It's completely unresolved. There's no closing chapter. There's just, you know, these various branch out events happening. Yeah,
like they didn't think it through.
No, they didn't. They literally did not. Do you know what's the worst part of this? Was the Machado lady, the one that flew to Norway and the one that met
the Nobel Prize winner.
Yeah. That flew to Norway.
Yeah.
Somehow got out of the country, making it seem like it was some sort of Indiana Jones, expedition to escape her own nation.
Yeah.
And who also met with Donald Trump to give him her prize that she got from the Norwegians.
I stopped following that part because I know that once you are a Nobel Prize winner, when you hand it over to someone else, do you ask the Norwegians, like the Nobel Prize governing body?
The Norwegians clearly stated they don't like even the Nobel program, which are run by the Norwegians.
Yeah.
Don't like Donald Trump.
Well, he's threatening Greenland, so ain't no way they do. Like, oh, come on.
And the downside of primarily what transpired there was a discussion of Trump immediately after what happened to Venezuela said, no, we will work with the exact government of Venezuela that you attacked. I mean, make it make sense.
I'm not a political expert, but doesn't that sound dumb?
No, exactly. Make it make sense. You threaten another country. Yeah, the things you are doing are not right. Then you do your action, and then you've got to work with the leadership that you aimed to topple, who are then the only leadership you can work with, because the rest of the world are going like, oh, okay. So that's what's happening.
Okay. Again, not oil expert, but from the knowledge of investment I have gathered from Robert Schoban's Introduction to Namibian Economy, is that the oil industry is one of those industries that's very heavy on investment.
Yeah.
Yes, and it takes a very long time for you to recoup the investment that you are pouring in, yeah, in billions, literally.
And
we can see that here at home. So, now, for you to convince someone, or for you to convince someone like the CEO of, the CEO of ExxonMobil, is because he's the one that, you know, was reluctant, basically accepted Donald Trump's proposal of going into Venezuela and, you know, and investing. One of the things that he pointed out was that before we get, and we've been doing this for a very long time, it's literally what we do. Before we get into a country to invest, we have to make sure that we are in good books with the people on the ground. And what happened between the US and Venezuela on the 3rd of January does not make the relationship between the U.S., U.S. citizens, not just the U.S. government, U.S. government, Venezuelan government, U.S. citizens and the Venezuelan citizens, they are not on the same page.
Yeah.
One part that was featured on The Daily Show by John Stewart was, in Venezuela, just shortly after the 3rd of January, there were groups that were so mad at the U.S. in Venezuela. They were literally they were running around the country looking for any American they could find to hurt them. You are telling me to take billions of my money in a country where there are literally guys that are looking for me, and if they find me, they could kill me. Like, look, for a businessman, it's mind-numbing why this is actually, why it's taking place. It's just one rookie move after another, which now you can't stop but asking yourself, where is this going?
And it's not going anywhere positive.
Yeah.
The other downside, obviously, has been trying to justify, justifying to me specifically that this Board of Peace initiative means anything, which is, the next particular concern, obviously, that Guterres also highlighted was that multipolar institutions are under threat.
Yeah.
So you need to pay Donald Trump $1 billion to get an invite.
Yeah.
But first you needed to have been invited to the Cool Kids Club, because that's technically what this thing looks like, to the Cool Kids Club. And in the Cool Kids Club, you need to pay $1 billion. So firstly, you need to confirm as a president that you want to be there, and you need to pay this $1 billion. Now, who are you paying the billion to? To Donald Trump's bank account? Or are you paying it to the United States of America and its citizens specifically to be in this thing that no one is sure of what this thing actually represents?
Considering where the Qatari jet went, I would say,
to a foundation, a Trump foundation.
Look, this exclusivity of organizations is one of the reasons why we have BRICS today. The Indian External Affairs Minister, Jai Shankar, pointed that out when he was asked, why did India join BRICS instead of the G7? I was like, well, they wanted to join the G7, but the exclusivity was through the roof. They're like, you know what? You must meet this and this and this and these conditions and all that. And they were just like, you know what? We're done with this. So now India is part of BRICS. So, this Board of Peace is not very different from it. And the initial idea behind Board of Peace was the reconstruction of Gaza, which is why the UN Security Council approved it. I think shortly after that, that was last year, November. Yeah. Fast forward to January 2026. Now you have this whole, more like a remodeled Board of Peace. It's like at some point in the early days of 2026, Donald Trump decided, you know what, new years, new me, and so, well, new Board of Peace, different from the one that the UN agreed upon 2025 in November. Now, if you say $1 billion for every country, if the UN had that requirement, Do you have an idea how rich or broke the UN would be right now? You know, if every country was able to pay that $1 billion,
and how much the UN just need for its operations that you and I spoke about at the end of last year was like 3.5 billion.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump solicits a billion a nation, a billion US from each nation. I mean, my goodness. Hungary is part of the EU.
Yeah.
So clearly, a 10 billion could have been, you know, just achieved like that.
Now, look, that's why a lot of political analysts are of the opinion that this is somewhat, is, you know, it's done on purpose to sort of like to, you know, to undermine the UN as an international organization. I'm like, if that is true, then how come the UN didn't see through this back in November? First of all, considering the guy in charge of the organization, have you read the charter that's governing that organization? It has Donald Trump as a chairperson all throughout that document.
Yeah, okay. I mean, the organization that runs it, Hamoud, what's his name? The administrative center is Donald J. Trump Institute for Peace, Washington, D.C. He names an organization after himself.
After dropping a few bombs on Christmas Day in northern Nigeria and then bombing the heck out of Venezuela. And there's a very long list. And also threatening Greenland. But don't worry, peace is a significant part of it.
Exactly. You know, it's going to be there.
You got to love politics.
This is not even politics. This is not even
politics. That's being petty.
No, it's not even about being petty. It's literally, yes, you're right on the petty aspect, but I'm trying to ignore the petty element. It is primarily a big concern for the world specifically because we've already invested in these multipolar organizations.
Yeah.
The downside is you can clearly see Donald Trump doesn't like politicians. All his actions are counter to what you anticipate a politician would do. A politician goes there, the new age politician after the Second World War.
Yeah.
Has to go.
They're more they lean more towards political correctness.
And no, not well. Okay, if we break it down.
Yeah.
If we are more direct.
Yeah.
They have to collaborate.
Yeah, yeah.
They have to cooperate. They have to convince. They have to, what's the other word? They have to do, you know, it's all these sort of like appealing to the inner human of the opposite politician that they're facing. You know,
yeah.
If you're facing someone from another country, we deal on a human to human basis.
Yeah.
Trump is literally throwing that whole playbook out of the window. It's down the toilet. The dog ran away with the homework, clearly with that contained in that book. And he's telling people, I'm not going to go through all these unnecessary channels, unnecessary things. Yes, if it was your business.
Yeah.
But no country runs like a business.
No.
And I've been explained that by two economists, both of them are lecturers in their advanced years, and they've both said literally, look, there is something attractive that Donald Trump does. He tries to get to the deal, but the downside is he tries to circumvent the whole idea of the original deal.
In other words, always try to find a workaround when the rules set in place doesn't suit you.
We agreed on the rules. Look at okay, Helmut. This was a discussion that happened, just at the end of last year. It was regarding the International Maritime Organization.
Oh boy.
Now, there are two, I did not know that this organization is just as old as the ITU. It's one of the two of the older, UN organizations. So the IMO, slightly younger than the ITU, but they were also literally, if you look at their laws are older than the principle and the agreements that govern the ITU. The laws that the IMO was built upon was literally the laws of the high seas. Now, who were the big nations of the high seas? There's one there.
The British, Spanish were there.
The British.
The Portuguese.
So it was the British, the Spanish, the French, the Portuguese. Then along, you know, you bring in the other guys like the Russians. Because many of the other European nations were not heavy on having navies.
Yeah.
The navy played a secondary role. But there's only two countries that literally had massive navies in human history. It was the British and the Spanish.
Yeah.
The Spanish Armada was completely obliterated after like the 1700s or something like that,
mm-hmm.
because they could rebuild it after that war with the British, but they never had that glory anymore. Now, if laws that existed then between sea exploring or ocean exploring nations, those guys just used that those laws and then just ascended it into a global organization known as the International Maritime Organization.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the IMO was set to unveil. They were going to introduce the first green agreement. The first climate agreement was at the end. It was supposed to happen at the end of the year, last year.
Yeah.
Then, it's so funny, the time of the sequence of events. Then, I don't know which one of the Trump administration officials, the high ranking officials, but The press secretary, what's her name? That Caroline Leavitt or whatever her name is. She writes this scathing, and it was a scathing attack on the organization because it's a UN organization. The scathing press release about the ideals of this agreement. Now I've tried to find this agreement to read it, the text, the original text that would have been agreed upon.
Yeah.
They write this thing. Because all these nations came together in the specific spot somewhere in Europe. And I could not find whether Namibia was there, was present. But Namibia showed up with, the Namport CEO showed up with the Rotterdam CEO to champion the Green Hydrogen Initiative at another event that took place after that whole squabble of that first Green Deal. So literally, the US complains, then they shout, yeah, this Green Deal is going to impact the rights of Americans. And then Saudi Arabia just makes a suggestion after this complaint by the US.
Mm-hmm.
Saudi Arabia makes a suggestion, and then the whole Green Deal is literally thrown into the dustbin because now they've got to assess the concerns from the US and from the Saudis regarding what are their issues regarding this deal. The EU guys were ready to sign. Some other major seafaring nations were ready to sign. They were literally signing. Russia stayed quiet. So the assumption would have been that Russia was probably observing where this thing is going to.
Mm.
The Chinese also stayed quiet. They were also trying to observe where this thing is going to. But that the concerns literally came from two countries that are actually big buddies. The US and Saudi Arabia. Complained. There was no like majority complaining. The US and Saudi Arabia. Now you've got to ask yourself a question here. What is the aim of this deal, Helmut? This deal is aimed at literally taking away all fossil fuel usage in anything that is seafaring. Why? They don't know the extent. And literally, they don't know about the extent of which pollution is happening on the seas. And the seas, the oceans are literally the last ecosystems that have not been completely damaged by human activities. And the idea here is literally that the IMO starts in their own neighborhood with their own specific sector, and they introduce this green energy transition across the board. All member nations adopt it, and voila, there you go. No. Now, we've got to wait for literally how this kicks off. But that's not going to be the only development. I have a big concern, Helmut, because it's a conversation we still have to do. It's ending tomorrow. Today's the 4th. There's currently going on in the UN the negotiations about the UN tax framework. This will be an international tax framework. Why? Because developing countries have got issues with these multinationals that come from the global north, predominantly many of them American.
Tax evasions.
For tax evasion, tax avoidance. for having or being started from or for their financing flowing through tax havens. The issue was, it looked like the tax havens are our issues as developing nations.
Yeah.
Hanakam, it's the global north guys who are the ones maintaining the tax havens. France has got a whole bunch. The biggest one is owned, the biggest collection of these tax havens is owned by the British.
And the French.
And the Americans have got internal tax havens. Like the state of Delaware. The state of Delaware, Helmut. There's like 10,000 people in that state. It's as big as Windhoek. It's a state, the state of Delaware. It's a tax haven internally in the US.
This problem is only going to get worse. If you look at how the this is also something that the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres emphasized in his speech. And that is there's a global, especially Western world and countries under Western influence, in terms of governance. There are a lot of the people that find themselves in this area, you know, in this part of the world, can easily tell you that they say, especially in developed countries like the US, there's a lot of swinging in governance power from the government to technology companies.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what the you know, Antonio Guterres basically says, that without the right guardrails in place, this shift of governance power or governing power from the government, from the elected elected governing individuals, because we are looking at representative governance here. We're talking about democracy at its core.
Mm.
The people that you want making decisions about about everything governance, you want those people to have gotten to have gotten into office via public votes.
Yeah.
So the public, voted for those individuals to end up in that, to be in that power, in whatever public office they happen to find themselves, whatever branch of the government, executive, legislative, judiciary, you name it. There's just one problem. This swing of governing power from the, from the government to technology companies is what, the Secretary General, UN's Secretary General, basically observes that it's most likely, it's going to take us in the direction of instability when our goal, especially when it comes to technology, is to go the direction of innovation.
Yeah.
Instability is where we are headed, because there is now too much concentrated, unchecked, unfiltered power in the heads of technology companies. That is actually the power that is reserved for elected representatives.
Yeah.
Because, if there's too much, if we live in a democratic or constitutional republic like, like Namibia, everyone that's in public office, everyone that was voted for or appointed in public office, there are measures in place of how you get them out of office if they get too drunk on, too drunk on that power.
Mm.
Except there is no equivalent for that in the corporate world.
No, there isn't.
Because it's a, it's a predominantly private space.
And the internal governance can be as murky as, okay, I don't want to be completely vulgar, but it's as murky as river water.
Yeah.
Think about it that way. River water that, a river that is flowing for the first time in long time of rainfall. That's how murky it can be. Yes, you can have something that sounds clean and spick and span on paper, but the internal governance,
reality.
But how the machinations go in reality is an ugly business.
Yeah.
And I mean, I would be afraid of trying to understand what were the internal governance structures and issues that were in the Donald Trump companies. When he was directly still running affairs, which he probably is still running directly.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's murky stuff. And anyone would come and say, yeah, Dwight, but that's just what, work life is about. You don't get, it's nothing, you don't get, fairy tales in doing business and the likes. I know, but there are certain experiences that you will always, they will always catch you.
Yeah.
Specifically when it comes to like working in the private sector. There's a lot of negotiations. It's not to say that everybody is bad. but there's a lot of people specifically that they hammer on using intimidation, and intimidation is part of their
like
business
strategy. Like strong-arming someone.
Yeah, and intimidation is part of their business operations. I mean, even here locally in Namibia, there's an interesting story that I read about a local businessman who was literally, he took a local bank to court for literally trying to strong arm the officials of this local bank. And this bank said, no, they reserve the right who they want to sell their products to.
Yeah.
So in for many people who think that, you know, the world of being a business owner is hunky-dory, is all bells and whistles and everything is just lovely and fun. No, there's a lot of grafting. You've got to get ugly, and you will get ugly for your money.
You're gonna have
to get ugly, and you can see it. That's what Trump is about.
Yeah.
Even though the journalists don't like him, because for some reason I don't know what's wrong with the journalists that obviously speak the worst about him, is that they speak as if they know him personally. That's the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
Many of them probably have not even been in the same city as that man at one particular
scenario. And then they talk about him.
Yeah. However, you can see that much of what they're talking about is based off secondary information. Secondary information being third-rate information. They read through someone else's article, or they saw through someone else's TV channel. They weren't there. They didn't ask the question. They didn't get the knowledge firsthand. So, from Namibia, we here, we can obviously see the developments coming. But we're not focusing on the man, because we've seen him before. We're focusing on the clear and obvious template he has put down. No one anticipated that 3 January would happen. But he clearly stated it back in September 2025, when the national security strategy was unveiled.
Mm-hmm.
He clearly stated it, Elmo.
Yeah.
That was an obvious and clear warning to the world.
And the think tanks that are in charge of basically either directly or indirectly influencing how the policies are shaped also put that on their website.
Yeah.
I remember reading through that. I think that was earlier this year.
Mm.
Yeah.
So everyone should have seen 3 January was about to happen.
The strong arming. This is something that we are only acknowledging now, especially in the mainstream media of things. But this is something that has been going on for a very long time.
Yeah.
The world of geopolitics is not what it appears on paper. Actually, nothing is. The strong arming by big countries especially small countries that can't stand up for themselves is something that is now heavily emphasized, these days. It started off with the Canadian Prime Minister's speech in Davos to, a speech that was given during the opening of cabinet on Tuesday, on Monday.
Mm.
Today's Wednesday, on Monday by the president, and yesterday during the opening of the national, the official opening of the National Assembly. A part of the president's speech yesterday that I also emphasized on yesterday was that powerful nations are increasingly asserting their interest in ways that challenge multilateralism and the rules-based international order.
Yeah.
This is something that the Secretary General also emphasized, that international law is being trembled, cooperation is eroding, and multilateral institutions are under assault in many fronts. So international organizations, including the UN itself, which a lot of political analysts are of the seem to be having the point of view that the Board of Peace could be, could emerge or evolve into the challenger of the United Nations as an international, as a master, call it master international organization. Now, here's the thing. That's the part now that, drew me to this, to the press conference of 2026 UN Secretary General's priorities.
Mm.
And he reminded the world that unipolarity. Yes, the world is dividing into, you know, the time of unipolarity sort of like became, you know, went full blown after the fall of the Soviet Union. Because after the fall of the Soviet Union, these did not have, you know, contender of the same caliber militarily and economically to basically, you know, tell them no when they came asking for something or challenge them when it comes to border issues, wherever they wanted to be. They went there and no one said a thing,
yeah.
Which is why they are known to have, you know, very interesting encounters with, with China in the, you know, in literally what's called the South China Sea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, with that, from 1989-1990, the fall of the Soviet Union, and the world basically at this point became the U.S. playground because, they didn't have a competitor anymore. And slowly, actually, I think they got a little too drunk on their power. They didn't even see China rising. Until one day they woke up and was like, hang on a second. Now there's someone that can compete with us militarily and economically and technologically. And it was just too much to swallow all at once. And for a lot of developing country, for a lot of blocks that are dominated by developing countries like Africa, they were considered more of an afterthought in terms of trade. They were just looked at when they were talking about things like foreign aid.
Yeah.
Yeah. And where are all the terrorist activities taking place? But China took advantage of that ignorance in terms of market relations. And just started, you know, building infrastructure. By the time that a lot of Western countries woke up and realized, okay, now they have roads, they have ties with China, they have economic ties, they have trade relations. That's when they started. That's why even in the, you know, national security strategy, they are emphasizing more on trade relations with Africa than just focusing on aid. Why now? It's because after the fall of the Soviet Union, the U.S. went like, okay, well, the only guys that can challenge us are no longer in the picture. So now it's just us and the world is our playground. Mm. But this is where the political advice or economic advice now, it's not going to help very much. It's not going to help very much, especially if it's going contrary to what the Trump administration, especially what the Trump administration is after. If any advice is offered that's contrary to what they're, you know, to whatever interest they're after, I don't think it's going to be taken. Canada's invitation to the Board of Peace is one example.
Yeah.
All the Prime Minister said was, we have known for 80 years that international law in its application is not as international or equal as it is on paper. Because, well, if you have a strong enough army, you can just go to any part of the world and do whatever the heck you want. And in part of his speech, McKinney, actually, in a somewhat a very joking way, because he laughs at the end when he references, Anthony Blinken's, 2023 Munich Security Conference, where he said, in the international community, if you are not at the table, you are going to be on the menu.
It is real.
Yep.
It is profound, and it is a fact.
It is a fact. And in my favorite part is the Chinese equivalent of that phrase. That and it goes something like, if you are not, you know, if you are not the knife or the chopping board, then you are the one being chopped.
I know, guys. I know. But it is a fact. These are facts.
Yeah, these are facts. But the thing is, which is why I kept saying that, what the current Canadian Prime Minister pointed out at Davos in Switzerland, we all knew these things were taking place, which is why I like to say, guys, a few years ago, if you said that, chances are very high you would have been labeled as a conspiracy theorist.
Mm.
But the thing is, these are one of those things that we all know it's taking place on the ground. That equality is not very equal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there are a lot of celebrities and basically prominent figures that have come out and pointed at this, that, you know what, equality on paper and equality in practical reality are two different things.
Mm.
Yeah. The shift in power from governance, the shift in governing power from governments to technological companies. This is also one of those concerns that is, becoming more and more of a problem in the global, especially in developed countries. Here's the thing. Shortly after the kidnapping of Maduro, the White House Deputy Chief of Staff, Stephen Miller, was interviewed by, I think that was by CNN. They were, what the guy that was interviewing him wanted to find out was two things. What is the way forward with regards to Venezuela? Are they going to, have some kind of legitimate leader? Depending on the word legitimate leader in this way, in this case, is very fluid. Now, I know. Got Michelle Bray.
At ShopRite, our low price promise is to always help you save when you need it most. Make every dollar count this January and save big on deals like 6x1 liter Rite brand long life full cream milk, only $119.99 per pack, and 5 kg Rice King long grain parboiled rice for just $89.99. Don't miss out. Visit your nearest ShopRite and save more this January. Offers valid until 8 February 2026. ShopRite, lower prices you can trust. Always.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. 30 past the hour of 5 or 32, 6. Take your pick. Taking your pick. Matthew Miller was, Stephen Miller was asked one question. What's the way forward for Venezuela?
Yeah.
With regards to leadership. And is there going to be a military confrontation with regards to taking over Greenland? He didn't answer the question directly, but one of the things that he said that came out in terms of, just the sheer arrogance is that, this is a superpower. Mm. And under Donald Trump, these are his exact words. We are going to conduct ourselves as such. And, the guy conducting the interview was like, hey,
this is going to be difficult.
Yeah, this is going to be difficult. Now, that mentality and the foreign, and the diplomatic relations don't go along.
And that's specifically why Guterres said, you don't know what the reaction would be.
Yeah.
The reaction would be something. Venezuela is still an
open-ended question.
Well, question. Okay, you want to use question. I'm going to say it's still an open-ended action that has happened.
A fiasco.
Because there's still a reaction that we have to observe.
Yeah.
But the reaction is not just about coming through from one stakeholder or from one specific focus group. Mm-hmm. It's not just about the U.S. oil companies who are central to this discussion, as Trump makes it made it seem that it's only the U.S. oil companies that can solve or solve the economic woes of Venezuela. But the country was sanctioned
by guess who?
Those same oil companies are still going to act there while the country is still sanctioned.
Yeah.
And then you give the responsibility of developing Venezuela to US oil company executives. That's not their job.
Nope.
That's really not their job, which makes things.
That's the job of the government of Venezuela.
So, and if the government of Venezuela tells those US American executives, you're going to get nothing,
no
dollar out of this agreement, what's Trump going to do?
Especially if you are a company that's dumb enough to already have spent billions of dollars at the time. Yeah. How are you going to get it back? Because, ConocoPhillips is still battling
Venezuela in the court.
Yeah.
And Venezuela as a country.
They're like, look, we would like to pay you, but it's your government that sanctioned us, so.
Yeah. Or we don't want to pay you because it's your government that sanctioned us and invaded us. So it makes things just a lot more weirder.
Just makes it even more complicated.
Do you know what's the weirdest thing also about even about Greenland, Helmut? Was that, you know, one of these international news stations guys, this one, it wasn't the Deutsche Welle guys. It was, I think, Euronews, from the EU. So they went over to the capital city of Greenland. What's its name? Knut. They went over to Knut and they met with.
Kind of what now?
Read it like knee, you know, the joint here on your body. Uh-huh. Read it like knee, but you have to say the K. So this time it's not a silent K. It's only in English where you get silent letter. So they went over to Knut and then they.
With their knives.
and by walking with their knees. So they went over to Knut. They landed there and they decided, let's talk to locals of the town.
Yeah.
One of the locals, because they also have like a local government there in Greenland and it's based in Knut. So they spoke to one of the members of that local government. She's a direct politician from the community.
Yeah.
So far, we've only seen the governor of Denmark. The guy looks very European. We've seen, who was the other person? There was another person also from Denmark, a high profile person, but the person looked very European. When this news crew went on the ground in Greenland and spoke to the other locals there, he spoke to the indigenous population, which is the Inuits. Now, the Inuits are literally the Eskimo people, you know, yeah. The people that come through from Alaska and from Northern Canada, yeah. Alaska, Northern Canada. The Inuits are also very, very closely related to the Mongolians from Mongolia and the other Mongolian related peoples that live in Russia, like Vladimir Putin. Because Putin has got, he's got Mongolian characteristics.
Mongol features.
Yeah, features. So, as they interview this lady, she explains. Now remember, Greenland has always been a Arctic base for the Americans.
Yeah.
It's a long-standing agreement.
In the 1950s.
Since the 50s.
Yeah.
But the Americans have opened and closed so many military bases on Greenland. They've had various locations on Greenland.
Yeah.
It doesn't stay there for long. Currently, the one that's operating there is so far the longest operating base of the Americans.
Yeah.
The downside of when you look into the human to human, the people to people relations of Greenlanders and Americans is that there has been clear accounts of racism committed by American soldiers against the local Inuits. And this is things from the 50s onwards. The lady explained that the relations have always been
a sour one.
Well, you want to use sour? I would use bad, because the moment you reach a level of where there's clear discrimination being committed by one party onto another, you are no longer on sour level, Helmut. You're literally in bad. You're in bad books level. So there has been clear scenarios and reported cases of clear discrimination, bad behavior, specifically racist behavior by Americans prior to, you know, now, where the relationship has not been all good and well between Greenlanders and the Americans. Now, when she made that statement, I was like, wow, for a territory that's not the territory of the United States, that's pretty rich for them to treat people from another, you know, from another group. It's not anything special, because we're humans. I have seen the worst of humans before. Yeah. It's nothing special. However, it brings to focus a talking point that is not brought into focus, Amon. What has been the relationship between people of Greenland and between American soldiers? Well, you can just go to Afghanistan, where you will find the very weird reports that were brought out by the Americans. It didn't happen to the British. The British were in the most, what do they call it? The most, they were in the riskiest region or province of Afghanistan. Helmand. province. The British got to secure Helmand province. The Americans were the ones being shot at by the Afghans, the local Afghans. The Americans were the ones that were having the surges in bombing, you know, street bombs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The Americans were the ones in the American quarters of Afghanistan, where the Americans patrolled and operated. Not where the other NATO guys were, not where the other Brits were. Yeah, the Brits did have their instances. Sure, they were targets as well. I mean, I don't know if they came back for a territory that they lost in the 1800s, but yeah, they were there, you know.
That's what I was about to ask. What resources was there? The area they were occupying.
Okay, so what happened back in the 1800s? That was just before the Boxer Rebellion and the Opium Wars of China.
Yeah.
Was that the Brits were trying to expand, they were trying to expand the, as they call it, the British Raj. So the British Raj back then was Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh together. And the Brits wanted to expand into that part, which is known as Afghanistan. Because on the other side of Afghanistan, you find Iran, which was that time known as Persia. So the Brits tried it. The British tried to obviously expand. And this is obviously after the British Crown had made the East India Company persona non grata. If you don't know what that was, dear listeners, I had a discussion at the end of last year about the world's largest corporation that existed, which was the Dutch East India Company. Now,
that was not even a company. That was a nation state. I mean, they had their own army.
Yeah. And second to the Dutch East India Company was the British East India Company. It was the world's second largest company in the world with the amount of riches and revenues that they generated from their activity.
Yeah.
So the British East India Company was the one that actually laid the ground foundation for colonizing Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh. The British Crown just then sort of like made the company illegal because they at one stage they tried to challenge a British political policy, and then the king just went like, I'm the boss here.
You can do it there, not here.
No, not even there. Because if they do it there, they can literally shoot down British naval ships.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, no, the company then must go. So the company was literally
dismantled. Sort of
like, not dismantled. But dismantled is sounds like pushing a paper from left to right situation. But yeah, so when that situation happened, obviously, the British tried to invade Afghanistan. They were almost the first. They tried to invade Afghanistan. They were pushed out. The Soviet Union tries to invade Afghanistan, gets pushed out. The Americans obviously went in there for 20 years, sat there with their NATO buddies and support guys, and they were warned in 2002. I remember this. I was in Grimatrik, Helmut. They even, CNN even brought on Russian generals or Russian soldiers that...
To explain to them from experience.
To tell them, do not invade Afghanistan. Don't think about it. Don't even contemplate that idea. It's a headache. No. The guys just said, no, we'll have
to... Yeah, you know what? I mean, you failed. We're going to do this.
Yeah. We are not the USSR.
Ha! We have a new advanced technology, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, the Soviets also showed up with advanced technology.
At their time, yeah.
Yeah, and they didn't get it right. So, Americans are there for 20 years with their NATO buddies. Every time they are asked, so when are you going to withdraw by their local electorates? Because it's obviously money flowing into that country that is not used in the US. And it became was obviously a headache. Yeah. Now, here's the concern. It was Donald Trump that signed the agreement to withdraw.
Yeah.
Donald Trump signed the agreement to withdraw. Biden just allowed it to happen. Donald Trump comes back and says, yeah, it's Biden's fault that we had that messy withdrawal. Come on, dude. Now, obviously, the Board of Peace, I have to correct myself. Board of Peace actually has two African countries on it who said yes. They still have to be formally inducted. Morocco and Egypt.
No surprise.
Yeah, no surprise. The biggest concern, obviously, has been, like I said earlier, even though Trump is trying to do away with the way, or try to do away with politicians in general, the political class, the downside is Trump comes from a specific segment of a population, which you can find in every country. He comes from the business class.
Yeah.
People who run private institutions, they've generated their own incomes and wealth. They've built up their own particular sort of like influential clout. They've got bargaining power. We even see it here in Namibia. There's bargaining power in the Namibian economy. Now, Trump is then trying to escalate this to international, to a national level in the US, an international level specifically in, you know, international relations. But here's the concern, Helmut. Do you know what governs international relations? As we know it today, as we know it today, the UN Charter.
Yep.
Because there's a specific thing that Guterres mentioned in his speech of last week was, before World War II, Europe was multipolar.
Yeah.
And even before World War I, Europe was multipolar. And that was a bunch of cousins, that multipolarity of World War
I. Oh, yeah, that was a bunch of cousins. Yeah.
That was a bunch of cousins who had armies.
Yep.
Before World War II, it was a bunch of just weird politicians. You've got a guy here who's not even a national of Germany, talking about German nationalities and the preferred, you know, sort of like eugenics, or should I just say the genes that should rule the world situation. And you had another guy who was, and you had a bunch of other guys that were trying to play, what do you call it, a weird diplomatic relations, the British and the French. It was the British that were like, yeah, don't worry, just don't attack Austria. Oops, he takes Austria. Don't take Czechoslovakia. Oops, he takes Czechoslovakia. And the Polish were like, hey, hello, what are you guys doing?
I swear Poland is always in the crossfire.
And then he flies over to Moscow, signs that agreement with Stalin about Poland. And then Poland tells the British, okay, now we need a defensive agreement.
Yeah.
Because that agreement between Stalin and the failed Austrian painter was literally so that they don't attach each other. They don't attack each other.
How'd that work out?
But the dumb thing is, it brought their borders closer to each other.
And
the one was itching to attack the other.
Exactly.
They both actually wanted to attack each other. They just wanted the excuse. Who's going to do the first move? That's it. They just wanted the excuse. So now, we are seeing things happening that we don't want to see happen. 50 years later, the Germans are now investing in a military base in Latvia, like I mentioned before I went on leave.
Time is a charm.
Yeah, remember that comment that I made?
Mm-hmm.
The German army invested in a military base in Latvia. Between Latvia and Germany, which is between Poland and those three nations, Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. There's a little enclave, Helmut. There's a little piece of land. It's the same. It's similar to what Angola is.
With Cabinda. Yeah, with Cabinda, yeah.
Cabinda is sits between DRC and...
DRC and Angola.
No. Between DRC and Gabon, I think. Or DRC and the other...
It's more of a cut out. It's basically supposed to be... Geographically,
yes,
it should be part of DRC. Yeah, but, throw in colonialism, colonial history and legislations, now you have...
It's just there.
Yeah.
So, there's this little enclave, a similar thing that Russia has. It's known as Kaliningrad. Now, you probably would not have heard much about Kaliningrad, Helmut. Kaliningrad's old name was Königsberg. Königsberg translates to, in German, to King's Town or Kingston, if you want to use the British version, Kingston.
Leningrad, that's from like Lenin.
Well, yeah, ish. But it's a city that the Soviets took, or the Russians took, from the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it didn't actually take it from the Germans, because if you look geographically, it should be a piece of land that should be in Poland today.
Yeah.
Kaliningrad. If it's in Poland today, part of Poland back in history, was part of Prussia. And that's before German unification in the 1800s. So that's before Otto von Bismarck's period. And the old Prussia back then was that Berlin was not the capital of the Prussian Empire or the Prussian state. It was Königsberg.
As the capital.
Was the capital.
That's a rich history.
So if you had to look at the actual scale of that German country that doesn't exist anymore, it included because the old image of what Poland had was that Poland did not have a port city. Poland did not have access to the Baltic Sea. So the downside of that was that you could see this German country literally lying above Poland. Czechoslovakia being part of the Austro-Hungarian territory, and the Austrians had a part or piece of Italy, a whole chunk of Italy. They had, I think, Venice was part of theirs. And
for how long have we been killing each other for territory?
Well, not us Africans. Technically not us Africans. It's that whole collection of guys, the Eurasian, the Asian / and European guys.
I mean, isn't like the whole Shaka story based on territory, kicking the heck out of each other for territory?
Okay, but here's the thing. It's not well documented, Hamut.
Yeah.
If you have to look at African history, and that's the downside I have about, meaning, which is one of my concerns about African history, is that in African history, it's verbal discussions.
Yeah.
Now, if you know how lethal broken telephone is.
Oh, yeah. The game of broken telephone, yeah.
As an illness. People embellish things. People add fairies and unicorns and dinosaurs in between. And Hanakam, it's a history of just 200 years ago.
Yeah.
But no one decided to write it down. And in the off chance that someone did write it down, it's the either written in German,
yeah,
or it's written in French, or it's written in British. Literally, Helmut. And that's one of the big concerns, primarily, if you look at African culture and African knowledge, is that we didn't teach, in some of the cultures and civilizations that lived here on the continent, we didn't teach ourselves to literally write down our sounds. Because that's what speaking is. We did not teach ourselves or develop ourselves or advance our civilizations to write down our sounds.
Where's Ge'ez from? The Ethiopian alphabet.
No, it's theirs. If you go look at it, it's theirs.
Yeah. Like it would be all
specifically
the time,
theirs.
Yeah.
It's the same thing if you also look at the Arabic alphabet.
Yeah.
Which is just scribbles.
Yeah.
Because I still don't understand.
That's also how I look at it.
How people read that thing, but yeah. But then when you come to what the Asians have, like the Indians, with their specific known history, even before Alexander the Great, you have to start asking questions. Because these guys were developing mathematics before the Europeans could actually try to count properly.
Yeah, when they then took credit for everything. Like the Fibonacci sequence, for example. Nope, Fibonacci. It's just old as time.
Well, the nice thing is, Helmut, is that various civilizations contributed to what we now know modern mathematics to be.
Yeah.
So the Romans and the Greeks stumbled upon the Arabic guys here in where you now have Israel and Syria, here in the Middle East, because they traded there. When they came into contact, obviously these civilizations, they saw the Arabic guys had this way of solving complex issues, complex calculations, specifically with business, specifically with various aspects of everyday governance and administration.
Yeah.
And they really realized, there's a way of converting Roman numerals into this number system that comes from, which is now known as the Arabic numerals.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't know if you heard about the joke about the Arabic numerals.
Was it?
The one guy made a comment, he made a meme, and he wanted to see who he would bait with his meme. So now they're going to get it. They're even going to do away, and this was under the ICE raids of last year of 2025. Yeah, now they'll even do away with the Arabic numerals. And the one American streamer is a guy that I sometimes watch, but sometimes his critical thinking annoys me endlessly. I mean, it annoys me.
Yeah.
And the guy went like, yeah, let's do away with that crap. And then another streamer reacts to his stream and he goes like, wait, isn't the Arabic numerals the numbers, is the number system we use today? Yeah. Which is literally the 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Yeah.
So yeah. Which also shows the level of you know,
not understanding.
I almost used the other word, but it is levels literally of the prejudice that is currently happening in the US. I mean, some things are justified, some things are not, but I mean, not knowing what the Arabic numerals are.
Yeah, like,
look, I had to Google it.
The level.
It's not something, it's not a word you use every day.
Yeah.
But it's also not something we were taught in our school.
Mm-mm.
You were literally just taught in Namibia, 0, 1, 2, 3.
That's it.
Your teacher did not say, this is the Arabic numeral system developed by this Arabic, great Arabic scholar or philosopher of whichever period.
Well, that I've got to tell you, who has a lot of influence in the way that knowledge is dispensed. Because, you know, believe me, if you read a history of a lot of things that are, especially in science and mathematics,
yeah,
there's a lot of Arabic names that are just more like,
I mean,
okay, there are a lot of things that were, you know, that were originally invented by a lot of, you know, Arabic guys that are just, call it renamed into some inventor who just, you know, at this point they're just taking credit for nothing because didn't invent it.
I mean, how many of these IT guys here in Namibia know that the world's first programmer, first known computer programmer was a woman?
If you're in IT and you don't know that, may I suggest catering?
Not just catering. They probably have to go ask their education, all the education fees back.
Okay, looking after
and give the money back to their parents, and then ask for a farming job somewhere. Because really, because this has to show the level of the knowledge of the industry that you're working in.
Yeah,
Helmut, how many times have I been told about how media actually came about? The very first instances of media was a guy that was. And this is found in the ancient civilizations there, and even in Africa, there was a designated group of people in the communities who told the stories.
Just by word of mouth.
They would sit at the campfire, if it was in Africa.
Yeah.
They would stand in the corner on a box, which looked like a soapbox, a little wooden platform in Europe, or in the Middle East, or in Asia. And then they would communicate with the peoples.
This is the message from the king.
It didn't start with the Gutenberg guy. Johann Gutenberg.
The printing press, yeah.
Yeah. It didn't start with him. It started with the very first instance of mass dispensation of information. How do you distribute information on a large scale? The printing press discussion was something else. Because you firstly needed people to be able
to read.
Who should have been able to read. Oof. And like you and I know, public education is a fairly new system. It's a fairly
really
new concept.
New in comparison to the printing press.
It's a concept that in many European countries only happened in 1900. You and I look through the Finnish education model, where they made basic education mandatory when? In the 1950s, after the Second World War. So
reading was a luxury back then.
Reading, writing.
From the 1700s, 1800s.
Up into that first half of 1900, there were many European countries even that did not make education publicly available. It was only for the elite few or for the powerful in society.
So if you can read, it's something that we take for granted these days, isn't it?
Exactly, and that's specifically why. And I'm not going to defend the UN. It's their job to defend themselves, because they've got enough people there that are paid a lot of monies
to do that.
That have to do that job. But I like, and I support the ethos, the message that they communicate through the world's member governments. Ensure the human capital, ensure that you invest in your human capital sectors, which is education and health. Ensure that you maintain these sectors and ensure that these sectors have adequate investment. Because health and education are not sectors that you can go say, oh, I paid $1 here. I expect to make $5 back. Mm-hmm. No.
You do that.
It's a blind investment regardless. It's blindly investing regardless. But yeah, I mean, that's some of the particular scenarios.
Yeah, like, okay, two major concerns, which can basically be summed up in one, you know, just two concerns which can basically be summed up in one major concern. And that is, the governance discussion. Because, the shift in governance power from, governments, voted public representatives,
yeah,
to technological companies. This concern is is quickly gaining attention. Like more and more people are talking about it. But there's one lady that works for Stanford University as part of a human-centered artificial intelligence division. She literally wrote a book titled, a tech coup, where she's airing sort of like a concern that, tech companies are gaining more power to the point where we are now just seeing the sheer government power itself shifting from, elected representatives,
yeah,
to tech CEOs. Which is a bad idea, because like I pointed out earlier, there are mechanisms put in place from the three branches of the government to make sure that it's not, power is not concentrated in, you know, only in one person or one branch or one group of people.
Mm.
So if you look at it from a governance standpoint, there are fail-safes put in place to make sure that power is not abused. The same is not the case in the corporate world.
Mm.
Because again, no one, you know, goes to an election to vote for a CEO. So what a CEO does with with a company that they are given power to run, that's, they don't have to ask, permission from the public for them to make, much of the decisions they make, as long as it's in line with the company's interest.
Mm.
As long as, it's approved by the board of directors or whoever is in charge, because it's a compartmentalized power structure. Here's the thing, that shift in power, it quickly becomes unchecked power.
Yeah.
Because the fail-safes that we have in the governance sphere is not going to apply there. Now, I totally understand the UN Secretary General when he's saying that this shift in power without the right guardrails in place, which are the fail-safes, which you find in a lot of public office, which are like the fail-safes that are used to stop public officials from abusing their public office, public office power. They are difficult, if not borderline impossible, to apply in the corporate world. Again, why? Because it's predominantly private space. You can make it public, but then it becomes socialism. That's not something a lot of Western countries want to hear.
Even though a lot of them actually practice socialism.
On a top level. When it comes to bailing big companies out, socialism. But when it comes to working to get to that company, yeah, well, capitalism.
No. True. Yeah.
Really? Like the 2008 financial crisis, revealed, the selective application of socialism for me. 2 minutes into the hour of six, a quick break, and we sign off on the other side. Home Run with Helmut and Dwight. Let's take a break.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura, and I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
And welcome back. The world is basically not... I don't like to use the language of the world is not what it was. like the world have changed, because whether you look at it economically, politically, the world have not changed. The conditions that we are all being aware of right now in the world of economics or the world of politics have always been there. We have just not acknowledged that they exist, because a lot of interest was at stake for a lot of countries that were on the quote-unquote good side of the big guys. Now, the big guy seems to be high on crack, and they are just cracking down, no pun intended, on everyone, including people that are supposed to be on their side. So that's why a lot of, countries are now coming to the realization that the comfort we enjoyed for a very long time is not, well, is quickly shifting, and a lot of things are changing, and there is nothing much you can do about it. The best you can do is, just come together as countries and decide if we wanna compete each other for breadcrumbs, or just come together and then join our forces together, put our resources together, and bake our own bread. But for a very long time, it was about just the small guys competing over breadcrumbs. And for a very long time, a lot of countries were content to some degree, if you can say, with the breadcrumbs. And now the breadcrumbs have stopped falling. And they can be stopped, they can stop falling at any time. And that's when a lot of countries are now realizing, oh, it can stop. Because we're talking about sanctions and embargoes as if they are new. Well, ask the Cubans. They have been in for like, 20, 30 years now? The threat of military intervention have been going on since forever. The threat of economic sanctions have been going on since forever. And again, I cannot see that. Oh, this is what I'm going to sing like forever. Greenland. Threatening military intervention in Greenland. That's when a lot of European countries, especially Western Europe, are coming to the realization that, oh, it can also impact us. Then all of a sudden, it's a big problem. It has always been a big problem. It's just that it's one of those things of, you can easily push aside because, well, it's not impacting me today. It's not causing me harm today. So as long as it's far away from me, I'm good. But nothing is new under the sun. Two, Justin Bieber was right when he said, never say never. You can say never today, but, well, it's going to come. It's just a matter of time. Now, putting all that aside, the concerns of the outgoing UN Secretary General here is a very simple one. Multilateralism, as the world shifts from, as the world shifts from the unipolar world to a multipolar one. Multilateralism, according to the UN General Secretary, is not going to cut it. The fact that you are going to have maybe 2-3 big guys that are competing for power. First of all, that's scary enough, because there's this phrase in African proverb, or more like basically world right now, that says, when elephants fight, the grass suffers the most. So having 3 big guys fighting over power is going to make a lot of countries now get caught in a crossfire. So that's not going to help. But the UN Secretary General is not against that. He's multilateralism. He's just saying, multipolarity is not a solution. You still need international institutions that everyone belongs to, and that will be built on international law that will maintain order. Otherwise, if multilateralism itself without any international institution and ipso facto international law that they run on to maintain order, if the absence of international law and international institution to maintain international order worked, Europe would not have found itself in World War I, because they were pretty multilateral. They were, they were pretty multipolar, if you can look at it that way. So they were multipolar. They ended up at war because even though they were multipolar, they had a lot of disagreements because they could not agree on one thing. Why? Because there was no unanimous consensus on what should be where and when. Well, from the look of things, that's the direction we're headed. Not fear-mongering, just pointing out the obvious. That brings us to the end of Home Run for today. Until tomorrow, same time, same place, on your favorite radio station, Eagle FM. Yours truly, Helmut. And Dwight, who is just about to bring you a China Corner. Stay tuned and stay safe.